The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Because of the kind of political polarization we're seeing in this era of geopolitical competition, because of the explosion of conflicts involving all kinds of dehumanization, often on both sides, I think we are seeing great pressure on the human rights system generally. And in those bits of human rights which are most sensitive and most difficult, like counterterrorism, and states seeing themselves as responsible for the security of their citizens and protecting the lives of their citizens. It can be very hard to get that message to stick, that the best way to ensure security is to protect the human rights of your citizens.
I'm Haman Hahn, Associate Editor at Lawfare. This is the Lawfare podcast for December 14th, 2023. Ben Saul is the Chalice Professor of International Law at the University of Sydney, Australia, whose internationally recognized work has focused specifically on the intersection of human rights, terrorism, and international law. The United Nations Human Rights Council voted to appoint Saul as the newest special rapporteur on the promotion and protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms while countering terrorism, which has become one of the most visible and urgent special rapporteur mandates at the Human Rights Council. He began his 3-year tenure, which can be extended to 6 years, on November 1st, 2023. I sat down with Saul for an interview about his priorities for his tenure, the intellectual frameworks and perspectives he brings to his role, and to get his perspective as special rapporteur on the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 14th, a new United Nations special rapporteur on human rights and counterterrorism.
For those who may not be familiar, could you walk us through who the United Nations Human Rights Council's special rapporteurs are generally and what they do?
So the special rapporteurs are part of what the UN calls special procedures, which are a series of essentially independent experts appointed by the council on particular thematic areas like counterterrorism for me, or geographic areas. The role of special rapporteurs is really to promote human rights in relation to the theme or country that they work on. There are a few core things that they do. So firstly, a couple of reports each year, one to the Human Rights Council, one to the General Assembly, of about 12,000 words on some kind of contemporary thematic human rights issue related to the particular mandate. And those reports are also written on the basis of stakeholder input. So it's a pretty open and collaborative process as well. Secondly, we undertake two official country visits each year, which is designed to be a kind of deep dive into human rights in a particular country. And then reports are written off the back of that and made public through the UN as well. Thirdly, we deal with what are called communications, which are things where, every week we might get complaints from individuals or groups or civil society organizations about, in my area, how counterterrorism law has been affecting human rights because somebody's been locked up or their family members have been executed or an NGO is being shut down by excessive counterterrorism laws. And we engage with governments and try to advocate quietly through diplomacy to improve the situation. If that's not possible, then we can reserve the right to go public and try to mobilize and advocate that way. In addition, on this mandate, I'd say there's also a lot of work around the UN counterterrorism architecture in New York, which has proliferated over the last 20 years.
And you started to touch on this a little bit, but can you tell us at a high level what your articulation of this specific human rights and counterterrorism mandate is and what it's meant to achieve?
Yeah, so I think the essential aim is to ensure that states, United Nations bodies, regional organizations respect international human rights obligations when engaging in counterterrorism activities. So that includes policing and law enforcement, intelligence and security, military operations, social and community activities, these kinds of activities to prevent and counter violent extremism, for example, which involve all kinds of interventions at different levels of society. You know, obviously, international law applies when countering terrorism. That's a point that's been affirmed multiple times by even the UN Security Council when it requires states to do things to counter terrorism in its resolutions. But of course, the problem is in this area, there's a tendency of too many states and even sometimes in the UN system to prioritize security over everything else, to not take into account sufficiently the human rights impact of what can be often very intrusive measures to counter terrorism.
Right. And you recently released your potential areas of focus within this very wide mandate for your three-year term, which included 5 new potential focuses, in addition to building on some of the priorities that the outgoing special rapporteur in this realm, Fionnuala Neolin, focused on during her tenure. Could we maybe start with your assessment of the state of the issues that she worked on, what she's leaving you with, and what you're most interested in building on within that set of issues?
The mandate is actually a fairly mature one in a way. I mean, it was established over 18 years ago now. There have been, well, I'm the 4th special rapporteur on this mandate, and the term generally is 3 years plus another 3 years, so up to 6 years potentially. Obviously, over that time, a lot of the kind of obvious human rights issues have been addressed by my predecessors. I mean, most of the impact of counterterrorism law on particular civil and political rights, economic, social, cultural rights have been dealt with in thematic reports. And that's incredibly valuable because it gives me a great resource to fall back on when those issues come up on a day-to-day basis with states. We can fall back on this great body of work, which has already been done. Obviously, some of the work is also pretty reactive, right? So initially in response to 9/11, way back in 2001, then, of course, Security Council resolutions require states to do other things in response to subsequent terrorism episodes, obviously around 2012 and after that. The threat of ISIS, Islamic State, provoked a new flurry of counterterrorism lawmaking on foreign fighters and so on. So when all of that stuff comes up, obviously part of the job is to react to that, and that generates a whole lot of new work. Some of the key issues which Fionnuala had been working on, which I absolutely would like to keep working on, are things like the impact of counterterrorism laws on civil society, opportunities for civil society to participate in United Nations and regional counterterrorism processes, the repatriation of foreign fighters from Syria. I mean, there are thousands of foreign fighters, their families and children still stuck in detention in northeastern Syria, and their states of nationalities are often largely washing their hands of their plight, even though they're subject to arbitrary indefinite detention, torture or cruel inhuman treatment, complete absence of due process or any meaningful judicial safeguards. I should say it's not only the foreign fighters. I mean, my concern also is for members of ISIS, like male fighters who are detained as well. because there are many thousands of them, mainly Syrians and Iraqis, but other nationalities as well. And we're talking, I mean, overall, in terms of the families, the children, the fighters, I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of people in indefinite detention in incredibly cruel conditions. Return of Guantanamo Bay detainees, and there are about 30 of them still left after two decades. It's not just those who are still left we need solutions for, but some of those have been transferred but are at risk of, for example, refoulement to persecution or death or torture in their own countries of nationality. So there's a considerable concern about those as well. New technologies is an important one. Fanula was working on spyware, artificial intelligence. I think a long way to go on the regulation of those issues so far as they affect the counterterrorism field. And then an important part of the mandate, which has always been there, is victims of terrorism. So we focus not only on victims of excessive state counterterrorism measures and violations by states, but also the adverse impact of terrorist acts themselves on human rights and the need to support the victims of those violations as well.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for giving us an overview of that. I want to ask you a follow-up on a few of those, particularly the new technologies question, which I think is a relatively new question that was explored under the mandate. How are you going to start approaching that question in particular?
So we would definitely like to issue a follow-up report to Fanula's report, my predecessor, on spyware. So her spyware report had sort of set out the effects of the use of spyware on not only terrorists and people who are security risks, but in terms of how that, you know, adversely impacts on a whole society, civil society, entirely, you know, innocent, human rights protected activities. And in that report, she was really trying to scope out the different approaches potentially to regulation of the use of spyware. And that report didn't set down any particular model of regulation as such. So it was really left to a kind of sequel report to think about what that model of regulation should look like. Now, Fanula tentatively pointed to a kind of liability-based model, and so I think that's what we would be hoping to explore in the second report. I'm only a few weeks into my role, and obviously I've been swamped with a huge amount of information about a ton of issues, and we have a dedicated staff member, a senior legal advisor, who'll be working on the spyware issue when she comes back and starts in the new year.
Great to know that there's someone specific who's going to be working on this. Relatedly, as a follow-up, the North Syria visit that Fanula made, as well as the Guantanamo Bay visit that she made, do you plan to visit those places again as well?
So at this stage, I'm thinking about my geographic priorities. So Fanula had focused a lot on, particularly, I mean, in terms of official country visits, she'd focused on Europe and Central Asia significantly, as well as what we call technical visits. So the visit to Syria and Guantanamo Bay are kind of not full-blown country visits, looking at the whole scene of counterterrorism law in the country, but a kind of deep diving into particular issues. So in terms of geography, I mean, I'm in Australia, which is, I think, part of Asia, and Asia is a huge and underexplored region in terms of human rights scrutiny of counterterrorism. So that's going to be one priority for me. West Africa is another one, because that is an epicenter of a lot of terrorism and counterterrorism activity at the moment. And then, of course, the Middle East. Northeast Syria is a big and important one for me. Fanula gained access to some of the places of detention, but couldn't get access to others, in particular where the male foreign fighters were being detained. she wasn't able to access those camps. So that would certainly be one which I'd be interested to follow up on. Likewise, on the other side of the border, Iraq obviously has been dealing with the fallout of Islamic State and detention of fighters, rehabilitation, etc. So that's a big part of the story as well. Look, these visits depend entirely on the consent of the states concerned. So in relation to northeast Syria, Fanula had the consent of the Syrian authorities who cooperated with that visit, as well as cooperating with the Kurdish authorities, the de facto administering detaining power in that region. So look, that's something which, you know, I'd have to negotiate with the states concerned, whether that's the, you know, the US for Guantanamo or Syria and others in relation to northeast Syria.
And these negotiations, can you just give us a sense of how they happen and what they look like? Do you email someone saying that you have an interest in performing a technical visit or doing a wider country visit, and then they have to, you know, you have to liaise for months and months, and then you might get an okay? Or how does this process actually just work?
So it is a fairly involved process. So some countries have issued what we call standing invitations to the special procedures, which means that they've given a kind of, at a very high level, a kind of general consent to these visits. But even then, you've still got to negotiate the specific visit with the country when a particular mandate wants to go there. And so, you know, that kind of high level yes doesn't necessarily translate into an actual yes for a particular mandate. You know, counterterrorism is, of course, one of the most sensitive mandates on human rights for many countries. So it is, you know, it is hard to get those consents if countries fear that they that their human rights performance might be exposed, or that they don't want certain practices to be ventilated publicly, because of course these visits, that the reporting is public. I mean, it's not like communications on individual cases where that can be dealt with more quietly or diplomatically. Country visits are an open, transparent process for everybody to see. You know, I don't think it should be seen as threatening by states, because, you know, my approach and the approach of many special procedures is we want to be constructive. We want to give credit where credit's due for positive practices in countering terrorism, and where there might be deficiencies. It's not a question of naming and shaming so much as trying to work constructively with that state to identify areas for improvement. Suggest good practices that you know we can bring to the table based on our experience across other countries' situations, our knowledge of standards and good practices elsewhere, and to try to help them, you know, lift their game in a really constructive way. Now, obviously, that goes both ways. I mean, if a government has no interest in constructively improving their human rights performance, then there are, you know, limits to what that kind of engagement can achieve, and there, you know, at that point might be absolutely a place for more public exposure of what they're doing. We have rules about country visits, which mean that we can, we have to agree certain modalities of the visit with the country. So that, for example, you know, if we want to talk to a detainee, a terrorist suspect, or some other detainee in a prison or a detention facility, that can't be monitored by the state. I mean, the detainee has to be able to speak freely to us, that there should be no risk of reprisal for talking to us. And there are just some countries where, you know, those kinds of minimum conditions cannot be guaranteed. So even if a country were to say yes, we might say no, because it just wouldn't meet the basic standards of a visit. So in terms of the practicalities, normally, you know, we wouldn't normally just, cold call or cold email a country. We'd meet with the ambassador in Geneva as a courtesy. We'd explain what the, you know, what the purpose of the visit is, why, you know, perhaps why we've selected their country as being of interest, what would be the kinds of things we'd like to do in that country in terms of who we might want to talk to, where we might want to visit, what would be the kind of themes we might be focusing on. They've obviously got to take that back to their foreign ministries at home. The foreign ministry isn't necessarily calling the shots. I mean, most of the time it's probably not. I mean, in many countries, the foreign ministry might be well disposed towards a visit, but then they might talk to security agencies or law enforcement, interior ministries, etc., and then they might not be so keen. And because they've got usually more weight than a foreign ministry, the answer, you know, would come back as a no. The final thing I'd say is, you know, even if you get a yes in principle, translating that into specific dates where you can actually visit can also be a considerable source of delay. And there are lots of reasons for that. I mean, it could be security, instability and conflict related. It could be change of government related. It could be lack of resources and manpower on the government side to just, you know, logistically organize a visit. There can be difficulties on the UN side in terms of resourcing and security and so on. So, you know, it is a pretty involved process for sure.
Yeah, definitely. But it also does seem like one of the most important things that the special rapporteur can do is just being in the places that are unavailable to the public.
That's right. And I mean, also from you know, the perspective of countries, there are, of course, a significant number of special rapporteurs. So one factor is also just trying to kind of coordinate with other special rapporteurs so that, you know, the same country is not being visited by, you know, 10 special rapporteurs in the same year, so that there's not that kind of fatigue and that each of us when we visit is genuinely doing something new or adding value to human rights scrutiny, which others among us haven't, you know, recently done in the same country.
Right. Another aspect of Fionnuala's work that you said that you wanted to continue working on is the interaction between counterterrorism law and international humanitarian law and peace operations. Can you talk a little bit more about what gaps currently exist from your perspective in those two realms?
So I think there are a number of kind of key problems which arise there. So, I mean, one of the at a practical level, one which many have been concerned about in recent years, of course, is the impact of counterterrorism laws on humanitarian relief and humanitarian action, humanitarian operations in conflict areas. So that could be counterterrorist financing laws dealing with the regulation of nonprofit organizations or charities and the financial and banking system writ large, which can prevent funds or resources being moved into areas of acute civilian need under conflict conditions. So, you know, if you're raising money for let's say you're a diaspora community trying to raise money for your fellow nationals in a foreign country affected by war, you know, for food aid or medicine or medical relief or whatever. The problem has been counterterrorism law has increasingly impinged on the ability to do that because of legitimate concerns about financing of, you know, armed or terrorist groups in some of those conflicts. But it's often had a really disproportionate impact because counterterrorism laws have been so strict, so absolute, lacking in exceptions for genuine humanitarian relief, even when that's lawfully permitted under international humanitarian law, applicable in armed conflict or admissible under human rights law, that's been, you know, shut off by counterterrorism laws. Even if it's not strictly made illegal, there's also been the problem of banks and financial institutions de-risking, which means they just don't want the hassle of compliance problems or regulatory problems with counterterrorism enforcement authorities. So they just get out of the business of dealing with accounts or transactions which go into particular areas of conflict. And so that, again, can impact on humanitarian operations. Now, there have been some improvements. So, in recent times, the Security Council passed a resolution which contained a humanitarian exemption from its counterterrorism sanctions regime, and that's a good thing. Increasingly, numbers of states have duly implemented that in domestic law. There's a long way to go on that because lots of countries haven't implemented it yet or haven't implemented it in its full scope. But that's only part of the problem, of course, because that's only an exemption to economic or financial sanctions. It's not an exemption to criminal law liabilities, like, for example, financing terrorism, providing support or material support to terrorism, associating with a terrorist organization. I mean, there's such a plethora of criminal offenses related to terrorist organizations in many countries, and many of them do not have a humanitarian or medical exemption for armed conflict. So that's a real problem. It's not so much a problem for multilateral organizations or international bodies like UN actors or the International Committee of the Red Cross, who might have immunity under international law from national criminal law in foreign domestic courts. But it is a massive problem for lots of their partner NGOs, their implementing partners and so on, who are still captured by national law, who don't have the same immunities. So that's one part of the problem. The second part I'd mention, just goes back to the really fundamental problem of the lack of an international definition of terrorism. So the Security Council has required all countries to implement such a wide-ranging list of measures to counter terrorism, but hasn't solved this fundamental puzzle of whether violence in armed conflict counts as terrorism or not, right? And so under the, many of the counterterrorism treaties, so-called counterterrorism treaties dealing with particular methods or manifestations of terrorism, going back to the 1970s, many of them do have carve-outs or exceptions for certain violence committed in armed conflict. In other words, war is not treated as terrorism, not because, terrorist violence against civilians can't happen in war, but because international humanitarian law already exists to regulate that field in a really comprehensive way. So if you deliberately murder civilians or take hostages, all of those things are already war crimes under the law of armed conflict. So there's just no need to tack on a whole additional layer of counterterrorism liability beyond that. And I think we see that play out in a whole range of conflicts where some groups of states regard an armed group in armed conflict as a terrorist organization. Other groups of states don't treat it that way. And that, that makes it really difficult in how we think about what's going on in armed conflict when, different groups of states are seeking to regulate it in quite different ways.
Yeah, definitely. And you are, of course, the person who literally wrote the book on defining terrorism in international law. So in addition to the work that you've done, for instance, for the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime, what more work is there to be done in this realm, and how is it going to interact with what you bring to the role as Special Rapporteur for Counterterrorism and Human Rights?
Well, I wrote that book on defining terrorism about 20 years ago, and sadly, states have not listened because there still is no definition of terrorism. Of course, there has been an ongoing treaty negotiation within the General Assembly since about 2000, 2001, the so-called UN Draft Comprehensive Counterterrorism Treaty. A lot of progress was made on that in the first couple of years, and then it completely stalled, not so much on the inclusive part of the definition, but on the exclusion. So in relation to how much state violence should or should not count under a terrorism definition, as well as regulation, and this is the big one, of course, how we regulate conflicts involving self-determination, national liberation, resistance in situations of occupation, Palestine, Kashmir. These are the kind of obvious ones. And so since then, it's really been stalled on that question that in recent years, it's been pretty moribund. There's not been any progress really to speak of on that question. Now, in some ways, that problem of defining terrorism, which you know the world's been dealing with for over a century, actually, has been circumvented by what the Security Council did after 9/11, which is to require by a binding Security Council resolution, 1373, back in 2001, to require all countries to criminalize, prevent, suppress in domestic law terrorist acts, but without giving any kind of binding operative definition of terrorism. Now, because they didn't define terrorism, that's what made it possible to pass that resolution. States were generally happy with it and have complied with it because it's allowed them the freedom to choose whatever definition they like of terrorism under domestic law. Now, the Security Council said, well, you know, of course, that's got to comply with human rights law, but we know in many cases those definitions are utterly non-compliant with human rights law. They don't necessarily meet the principle of legality in terms of being sufficiently precise and certain to allow individuals to prospectively know the scope of their criminal liability. In some cases, they're discriminatory. In some cases, they impact on protected civil and political freedoms. And even if they, you know, even if definitions are compliant, I mean, there's then, of course, the further problem of how they're abusively used in practice in societies with potentially weak judicial controls and very powerful security agencies, indefinite and or preventive pretrial detention, which goes on for years. I mean, all of that, you know, then springs from bad definitions. The Security Council in 2004 did adopt a resolution 1566, which gave a kind of guiding working definition of terrorism, which is reasonably human rights respecting and has been endorsed by my predecessors as a kind of quite good guideline. The problem is, you know, most states haven't legislated in accordance with that definition. Also, you know, so far as we can tell, you know, when UN counterterrorism bodies like the Counterterrorism Executive Directorate does its assessments of countries' human rights performance, they certainly look at countries' definitions, but because those processes are just not transparent, I mean, the reports by CTED, the Executive Directorate of its country missions, are not made public unless a government agrees to that, and most governments never agree to that being public. So we just can't see to what extent the UN counterterrorism bodies are seriously pushing back against terrible rights disrespecting definitions of terrorism. And the problem seems to be that you know, if you've got a bad definition of terrorism, it's not just the fact that the definition itself is bad if you then go on to prosecute someone for committing terrorism. Actually, the bigger problem is usually that a whole lot of other counterterrorism measures spring from that definition. So all of the kind of deep-reaching preparatory offences to terrorism, which are unlike what we usually have in regular criminal law contexts, offences relating to terrorist organisations, measures relating to preventing or countering violent extremism, preparatory to terrorism, even you know measures of surveillance, security, control, administrative restrictions on liberty. So you know, it has a compounding effect. You have a bad definition, and then you've got all kinds of bad measures which flow from that. You put it all together, and it ends up looking pretty terrible. So I think, you know, this failure to define terrorism is at the root of a lot of the really abusive counterterrorism practices we've seen over the last 20 years.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
So just to round out the discussion of your priorities for this mandate, you, in addition to what we've just gone over, identified 5 new potential areas of focus as well. Could you run us through the ones that you're most interested in focusing on from that list? I think you also might have received comments from international stakeholders on what they would want you to focus on as well. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. So I had a call for inputs to stakeholders, and I'm pleased to say there's been a huge interest in that. And I'll be wading through those submissions in coming weeks in preparing my first report for the council in March next year, but which is due in December. The first one, which I think will be the subject of my first report to the General Assembly in October next year, is on the impact of counterterrorism measures by regional organizations on human rights. So there's been a lot of scrutiny of both state human rights performance and performance by UN human rights bodies in New York. But in some ways, regional organizations have slipped under the radar and haven't had so much human rights scrutiny. They've been around and doing counterterrorism for a very long time. I mean, way back since the 1970s. But the number of organizations has proliferated. I mean, there are dozens and dozens of them now which are involved in counterterrorism, but also in terms of what they've been doing. It's not just occasional treaty making like in the past before 9/11. It's a proliferation of measures across all kinds of areas. So that's number one. And by regional organizations, I mean, you know, highly structured institutionalized ones that we're familiar with, like, you know, the European Union or the Council of Europe or, you know, the African Union, et cetera, but also informal networks like the Global Counterterrorism Forum, the Financial Action Task Force, and in the military domain as well. I mean, there are coalitions of military actors like in the Lake Chad Basin or the Global Coalition Against ISIS, Daesh. I mean, those are ripe for much greater scrutiny as well. Secondly, I'm interested in the involvement of non-state actors in counterterrorism. So that could be private companies providing security-related goods and services, including, you know, we mentioned spyware already. It also includes private military and security contractors, so groups like Wagner, involved increasingly in West Africa. But also non-state armed groups, which are essentially de facto state authorities. So again, we mentioned the Kurdish authorities in northeastern Syria. What are their human rights obligations in countering terrorism? And what are the obligations of the states which cooperate with them in activities to combat ISIS and other armed groups? Thirdly, and this has been, you know, a theme of interest to previous rapporteurs as well, but there's so much of this, I think it's worth looking at it holistically. That is this explosion of what we call administrative measures to counter terrorism. So things which sit often outside the regular criminal justice system or even entirely outside the regular civil court system, but which nonetheless impose all kinds of restrictions on liberty and freedom in countering terrorism. So there could be things like preventive detention orders, control orders, keeping people in prison even after they've served their sentence for a criminal conviction, because they're seen to be still risks to security. A ton of border and migration related measures, travel restrictions, exclusion orders, citizenship stripping, data sharing in relation to travel, etc. Prescription of organizations as terrorist for all kinds of measures, whether that's financial restrictions, travel restrictions, dissolution, etc. And then measures to prevent and counter violent extremism, which involve all kinds of often soft but not so soft measures that prevent or disrupt that kind of radicalization process. Fourthly, I'm interested in some of the counterterrorism work of particular specialized international bodies like the International Maritime Organization in the field of maritime security and the International Civil Aviation Organization. Again, actors which have long been involved in counterterrorism way back since the 1970s and 80s, but which are doing a lot more now beyond their conventional role in participatory, transparent, you know, criminal law treaty making, which was their original role. And the final one is focusing on accountability and reparation for large-scale violations of human rights in countering terrorism. So I think there are good practices here to be ventilated. Like I think the Colombian peace process is quite a good example, where There has been a genuine commitment to combating impunity, to truth-telling, reconciliation, compensation. At the other end of the spectrum, think of a place like Sri Lanka, where there's been almost total impunity for large-scale massacres of civilians at the end of the civil war in the 2000s. So looking at how the framing of conflicts as counterterrorism affects the way we deal with them in a post-conflict transition, I think is useful. We mentioned Guantanamo Bay already. I mean, again, the focus there has often been on, for obvious humanitarian reasons, getting people out of indefinite detention for over two decades and protecting people when they have been transferred from risks. But of course, the other part of that story is, again, a near complete absence of any meaningful accountability for really serious violations perpetrated seemingly by the United States in the war on terror in terms of torture, detention conditions, unfair trials potentially constituting war crimes. I mean, there's a whole story of impunity there, which I don't think we can forget about. Also because of, the role of the United States. I mean, it is a leader. It has an outsized influence on shaping how other states feel it's acceptable to behave in countering terrorism. So if you have, if you have impunity at the top, of course, we must expect that, other states will feel free to copy that kind of behavior.
I wish we had endless time so that I could go into each of those five things, but for the sake of time, I'll limit one follow-up about the point you raise about proliferation of administrative measures to counter terrorism, and you raise, for instance, designating terrorist organizations as such. In Australia, you had made headlines for advocating that Hamas and the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, would not be able to be designated as terrorist organizations under domestic Australian law. Without going, too far into the ins and outs of Australian law, what moved you to make that point? And can you briefly outline what the problems are with things like terrorism designations, for instance? I think that's something that a lot of people are aware of, and it's a mechanism that a lot of countries use.
Yeah, so on the question of designation generally, I mean, it can be potentially a useful device for containing the threat of terrorism. The problem is usually the way it's done, right? So there can be a lack of adequate due process and a lack of judicial safeguards that then make it suspect from a human rights standpoint. On the two examples you gave, I mean, they're both different, right? So the Revolutionary Guards in Iran, the problem there under Australian law, and I should say not only under Australian law, I mean, this is a pretty common approach in many countries' national counterterrorism laws, is that the Revolutionary Guards is part of the Iranian state. And this goes to our discussion of the definition of terrorism. Many countries' laws regard terrorism as a kind of non-state phenomenon, right? So although at a criminal law level, any individual can be liable for committing terrorism. So, a state official who takes hostages on an aircraft, still commits a terrorist offence. But in terms of the prescription of organisations as terrorists, Australian law and many other laws don't recognise, that you could designate part of a foreign state as a terrorist organisation. I mean, that goes back to the long debate about terrorism. The conventional wisdom on this was that state violence is already adequately addressed by other areas of international law. So if the state commits illegal violence, it could be a prohibited use of force under the UN Charter. It could be a violation of international humanitarian law or international human rights law. And therefore, you just don't need to additionally classify that as terrorism. Now, there may be all kinds of problems with that, conceptually and morally and whatever. But the other point is a more practical one, which is, states have foreign state immunity before other states' domestic courts, right? So if the point, and this goes to the debate in Australia, if the point about declaring the Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist organisation is to trigger the criminal law offences hanging off that designation, well, that's totally inoperable, because you simply cannot prosecute a member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards for a terrorist offence before Australian courts, because that's a state actor with state immunity. And we know that under the law of state immunity, there is no exception for, terrorist offences under domestic law. So that's the immediate problem. I mean, of course, you could potentially change your law, but then, the question is, where do you stop, right? I mean, so many states use violence against their political adversaries, assassinating people they don't like in foreign states, conducting military operations in foreign states. And if, as we said, national law definitions also don't exempt armed conflict governed by humanitarian law from definitions of terrorism, it suddenly means that any state involved in military violence anywhere in the world could be subject to a terrorist organization under Australian law or some other state's law. So it starts to become very difficult in terms of the diplomatic and political consequences of treating, bits of foreign states as terrorist groups. In relation to Hamas, just briefly on that one, again, I mean, this was a debate about, so Australia had long listed the military wing of Hamas as terrorist. It then moved last year to also list the civil part, so in other words, the whole of the Hamas organization, including its civil administration and governance of the Gaza Strip, as a terrorist organization. So the objection, the legal objection I was making, based on what we said earlier about the need to protect humanitarian relief and so on in armed conflict, was not an objection to whether Hamas should or shouldn't be regarded as terrorist or not. My objection was that if you do list it under Australian law as terrorist, it then triggers all of these very excessive rights-infringing criminal offences relating to involvement with Hamas as an organisation. And when an organisation is essentially a de facto government doing all kinds of civilian things and things for, to administer civilian life in that territory, totally unrelated to, using violence at all, that becomes a problem, because, people who collect the garbage for the Hamas administration are suddenly liable as either members of or associates with Hamas as a terrorist organization under Australian law. So the problem is the breadth of the offences, the fact that the offences aren't targeting conduct which is in any way harmful in terms of the commission of terrorist violence. And more than that, are directly impinging upon the ability to provide basic needs for civilians in Gaza, including, food and medicine and healthcare and so on, because all of those things are potentially criminal. And again, because of a lack of exceptions for humanitarian relief in the criminal sphere, the severe effects of those offences are not moderated as they should be in line with humanitarian law.
We've already kind of talked about your scholarly work on defining terrorism and how that provides a framework for how you're approaching these problems. You also wrote, I thought it was really interesting in your application for this position, that one of the things you were interested in doing was strengthening a culture of respect for human rights in countering terrorism within civil society, specifically as it pertains to the rights of the groups or individuals labeled as terrorists. Can you talk a little bit more about where that kind of view comes from, how you developed it? I mean, for instance, you and I first met last year when you were writing a piece for Lawfare titled The Unlawful U.S. Killing of Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was an al-Qaeda leader, of course, that the U.S. performed a targeted killing of.
Look, I think it's really hard to promote respect for human rights of people, states accused of being terrorist suspects, right? I mean, they're incredibly unpopular. There's no political constituency which really advocates for them. There are, some really dedicated, devoted NGOs and in civil society and lawyers and family members and so on, which of course mobilize and advocate very powerfully on particular, you know, issues or themes. But I think, 9/11 followed by the threat of ISIS after 2012 has just kind of reinforced this incredibly powerful security at all costs narrative. I mean, I think we're seeing this play out in the Israel-Gaza conflict at the moment as well, which has really put so much pressure on human rights. And although the Security Council and states, you know, of course, mouth formal commitments to protecting, promoting human rights in countering terrorism, that just isn't reflected in the kinds of resourcing devoted to human rights in this area, right? So, you know, security agencies, intelligence agencies, militaries being given massive amounts of new resources over the last 20 years, while human rights have received very little, are massively under-resourced, don't have anything like the same kind of institutional capacity to feed into the formulation and application of counterterrorism laws and practices. I think we see that also at the UN level. I mean, between the Office of Counterterrorism and the Counterterrorism Executive Directorate, you know, there are hundreds of staff with huge, you know, $100 million budgets, whereas, you know, my office of the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Counterterrorism is me half time, so like 2.5 days a week, plus two human rights officers in Geneva funded. That's it. You know, no one in New York funded, which is where where all of the counterterrorism activity happens. There are then, you know, 46 UN entities that are members of the UN Global Compact on counterterrorism. All of them are doing bits and pieces of human rights, of counterterrorism as well. Now, there are, of course, people doing bits and pieces of human rights within the UN counterterrorism bodies. I mean, there are human rights officers there. And there's a scattering of, you know, human rights expertise across the 46 UN agencies. But I think it goes to the point of the hugely disproportionate emphasis on repressive security law enforcement approaches and really a kind of fairly perfunctory commitment to human rights and indeed civil society engagement in counterterrorism in that process. And that's strange because, you know, the global counterterrorism strategy adopted by the General Assembly in 2006 has four pillars. Two of those pillars are human rightsy. So, you know, one is about respect for human rights and the rule of law in countering terrorism. One is about addressing what's called the conditions conducive to terrorism, or the root causes, in other words, which include serious violations of human rights by states. But if you look at the programming and resourcing across the UN system, those two pillars still receive far less than the kind of resources which go into the repressive pillars on law enforcement and other kinds of restrictive measures. And that's, you know, as we said, you know, at the state level, that's even more pronounced in terms of how there's such a focus on repression and resourcing of police, intelligence, security, military, and very little fed into the human rights side of things. Finally, I just say, look, I do think this is a really difficult global moment for human rights generally because of the kind of political polarization we're seeing in this era of geopolitical competition, because of the explosion of conflicts involving all kinds of dehumanization, often on both sides. I think we are seeing great pressure on the human rights system generally. You know, in those bits of human rights which are most sensitive and most difficult, like counterterrorism, and, you know, states seeing themselves as responsible for the security of their citizens and protecting the lives of their citizens, it can be very hard to get that message to stick that the best way to ensure security is to protect the human rights of your citizens. But I think it is politically a very difficult time for human rights.
Right. Right. And given the moment in which we're recording this podcast and the moment in which you found yourself entering into your role as Special Rapporteur, I do want to end the conversation with your specific input on the current events in Israel-Hamas. We touched on it a bit throughout the conversation here, but how are you looking at the situation on the ground now, and what aspects of the conflict do you think that you can play a role in helping to mitigate?
So I should say at the outset that there is another special rapporteur on the Palestinian occupied territories. So she naturally has the lead on the conflict in Gaza, and of course the explosion of violence in the West Bank as well. My role can play a role in supporting that work. I also have my own mandate, of course, in relation to counterterrorism measures in Israel proper. So, for example, expansion of citizenship stripping laws in relation to terrorism affecting predominantly Arab Israelis in Israel, expansion of terrorist offences relating to the consumption of terrorist publications, or just having essentially possession of certain material. Can now be criminalized. So, there are those things going on as well. Look, my message is predominantly this is an armed conflict between Hamas as a non-state armed group and Israel. International humanitarian law is the key framework governing that conflict. The point of humanitarian law is to provide a balance so that military parties can effectively do what they need to do in fighting and winning wars, while at the same time ensuring that the suffering of civilians and indeed of combatants is minimized so far as possible. Look, there have clearly been violations on both sides. I mean, legally, what Hamas did is in some ways easier because it was so blatant. I mean, war crimes of murder on a large scale, hostage taking, sexual violence, mutilation of corpses, indiscriminate firing of rockets. All of that is fairly clear cut. I mean, it still needs to be independently and impartially investigated, and any criminal prosecutions have to be fair and before a proper process. And Israel is currently thinking about potentially special models for the prosecution of Hamas. So I think that's an issue which needs to be watched very closely from a human rights and humanitarian law standpoint. On the Israeli side, a clear violation and ongoing violation of the obligation to allow and facilitate humanitarian relief, all of the essential things for civilian survival in Gaza, like food, medicine, water, sanitation, fuel, etc. Denial on such a large scale in the initial period of the conflict that it could well constitute the war crime of starvation of civilians. Secondly, I think in terms of the conduct of hostilities, the latest figures suggest 85% of Gazan civilians have been displaced from their homes. A majority of housing has been destroyed or damaged in Gaza. Most civilian infrastructure is either destroyed or heavily damaged. Sanitation, medical care, hospitals, all of this is barely functioning now in Gaza. The question for, in terms of assessing humanitarian law liabilities, on the one hand, of course, Israel's conducted well over, I think I saw one figure, over 11,000 strikes in Gaza. On one level, yes, of course, you need to know more about the targeting process involved in each and every one of those strikes. What information was Israel relying on at the time? Did it take all feasible precautions to verify that the target was military and not civilian? Also to verify that civilian casualties would not be excessive. Did they select a weapon which would not have indiscriminate effects in a densely populated urban area? So not using high explosive munitions where that's likely to collaterally kill large numbers of civilians. So yes, you need to know in some ways more about that. On the other hand, at a kind of meta level, if you just look at the sheer scale of destruction in such a short space of time, And if you look at the kind of ratio of civilians to Hamas fighters, which seem to have been killed, I mean, one figure I saw, and, you know, all of this has to be taken with a grain of salt because we don't really know with any accuracy figures about, for example, Hamas fighters that have been killed by Israel. But one figure I saw was, you know, 5,000 maybe Hamas fighters killed. I don't know if that's accurate. But overall, the Palestinian figures suggest 15,000 people have been killed in Gaza. So that means for you know, every Hamas fighter, you're killing two civilians, right? And you know, those Hamas fighters aren't necessarily, you know, most of them are not, you know, senior commanders. Most of them are just kind of foot soldiers, etc. So you're obliterating most of the civilian infrastructure of Gaza, destroying, you know, decades of development. Making 2 million people essentially homeless, killing large numbers of civilians. It's difficult to see how that does not involve disproportionate or excessive civilian casualties, indiscriminate attacks through the use of high explosives dropped from the air, destroying, you know, whole neighborhoods, whole apartment blocks, etc. And I think this is clearly the assessment of the United Nations. It's clearly the assessment of even Israel's closest Western partners, like the United States. It's clear that Israel has not been taking sufficient care to protect civilians in prosecuting this war. Now, you know, Israel has a right to protect its people from terrorist violence, but it has to do it in the right way. I mean, it has to. Instead of, you know, dropping bombs and flattening whole neighborhoods from the air, you know, you do need troops on the ground to combat Hamas in a more targeted and discriminate fashion. And that does put Israeli forces at more risk, but that is the price of respecting humanitarian laws' obligations to duly weight the value of civilian lives and to protect them from unnecessary violence.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your service as Special Rapporteur.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with me, Haymin. Much appreciated.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Pacha Howell. And your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osmond of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.